This week on Retronauts, Odyssey Who? Hi folks, Kevin Bunch here. In this episode of Retronauts, we have a very special interview to bring you. I recently got to speak with Oscar Grusman and Ton Kamir, who were two folks who worked on advertising and marketing on the Odyssey 2 in Europe and beyond, where it was known under a variety of names, but most notably VideoPack. They provide a unique perspective into the inner workings of the VideoPack and how well it did in Europe and other parts of the world. It's a perspective that I don't think you see very often in the English-speaking world, particularly when it comes to discussing video games in the early 1980s, where the common wisdom is that home consoles didn't really sell very well, and it was mostly based around home computers. So hopefully this clears up some myths and answers some questions. This is something of a follow-up to our Odyssey 2 episode, so if you haven't heard that yet, I certainly recommend it. The audio quality here is not amazing, but I think the information and the discussion that we had is absolutely fantastic and well worth listening to. So please enjoy, and I'll see you on the other end. So, this is Kevin Bunch. I'm joined today by two folks who were there during the heyday of the Odyssey 2 or VideoPack at Philips over in Europe. So, I suppose introductions. Start with you, Oscar.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. Well, my name is indeed Oscar Grusman. I am 71 years old, live in Holland, close to Eindhoven, where early days the headquarters of Philips were. I was once the product manager of VideoPack, game computers, in the group of the black and white television. I come back to that later, the organizational structure. For some period beginning of 1980 till mid-85. And besides me is my friend Ton, also living in Eindhoven. He was then the...
I was the advertising manager for the... Let's say for the whole black and white group, and VideoPack for whatever reason was part of the black and white television group. And I'm a little bit older than Oscar. I'm 84, and I was the advertising manager. And
Before we go in detail, like Ton was already trying to do, I'll make a sketch of the organizational structure of Philips in those days.
Sure.
If you allow me. Philips was, when I joined Philips, that was in 1979, frankly speaking, in the Video 2000 group. I came from IBM after working for Xerox for a couple of years, Rank Xerox those days. IBM, I sold their mainframe computers and so on. But in 1980, the Philips organization itself, when I joined there, was about 420,000 people, employees worldwide. And it was broken down in a number of product divisions. I think there were, I cannot remember exactly, but something like 12 or 13.
Yeah, 12 or something like that.
You had audio, you had video, you had medical systems. You had the chemical
components,
Duvar chemical, Polygram, etc. Defense systems,
healthcare,
data systems, electrolytica or something like that.
Domestic.
Small domestic appliances and major domestic appliances, what we call these days white goods. That were the product divisions, and the management of the product division were all located, more or less all located in Holland and in Eindhoven itself, the headquarters. But there was a matrix structure worldwide. I think more than Philips was active in more than, say, 100 countries. And each of the product divisions had in a country, yes or no, a local sales or a local industrial organization or a local development organization. We call that a matrix structure. And that was very complex for the top management of Philips to manage, because there was a high degree of autonomy or perceived autonomy in the countries where we were all active. And that means that in a number of product divisions, for example, audio, video, they were in most countries represented by an own organization. But if you had some more in the gray area, a defense system or something like that, then they were only available of an own organization in a very limited number of countries, say 5 or 10 or 20 or something like that. That means that there was now and then a cowboy concerning management, from management point of view, a cowboy philosophy. There were a large number of people in the local countries who did not follow the product policy or the commercial policy as defined in the headquarters. That was the situation when I joined the group where Ton was already working. How it all started with Videopak, in 1978-1979, we had a guy in the product division, I talk about the product division television, in 1979-80. That was then separated from audio, but it was in the video group, I think it was called, video group.
Yeah,
VIDAC. And in that VIDAC group, there was a video equipment group. There was video recorders, color television and black and white television, I think. And there was a certain guy, John Shuttleworth, maybe you have seen that name in the past somewhere in some documentation, who had a close cooperation with Magnavox in Knoxville, because in Knoxville, Tennessee, there the Odyssey operation started. In fact, as a nice follow-up. I really don't know why they started over there. Referring to that cowboy world in those days, from management point of view. America was far away from Holland, of course. And there was a project called Odyssey. I think it was, people were enthusiastic about ping pong games and all those kind of things in 77, 78, that area, or that period, I would say. And there was a kind of a game system with a keyboard, plastic keyboard, and the cartridges that you could plug in. And there were a number of video games developed locally by all kinds of local software developers in the neighborhood of those guys who were organizing that in 78, 79 in the States. On a certain moment, some wise guy said, if they are successful and they sell quantities in the States, why won't we do that then in Europe as well? And that is the moment that John Shuttleworth, I think it was 79, started to cooperate with Tennessee, and they started producing the G7000. That was, in fact, the same system, but then based on, I think it was Paul Sekam.
Yeah,
and you had NTSC or so in those days.
Yeah.
And we imported, as far as I remember, we imported quantities, that was before my time, imported quantities in 79 to Europe. And in Europe, they were being offered, as it worked in those days, offered to the national sales organizations in that matrix structure, who is interested, and where is there already a market development? Sorry, like something like Atari or so in those countries in Europe. The quantities, hardware were purchased, consoles were purchased, and a number of games came with that, which were in principle, at that moment, organized by also by third parties, by a software group somewhere in the neighborhood of Knoxville. Enthusiastically, we took a number of those cartridges over. We started selling them, but it was real BS, as you say in the Dutch, because when the countries received their goodies from the States, I think it was for the production from the States, it simply didn't work. And there was a certain moment, from technical point of view, the consoles didn't work and the joysticks didn't work. And on a certain moment, we said, should we continue with that, yes or no? And then I don't know exactly why. I was on the verge quitting again with Philips, and I came from IBM, and they said, Oscar, do you want to be the successor of John Shuttleworth? And I said, ach ja, if not, why not? Eh? It's interesting. A little bit hardware, a little bit software, and so on. And that's the way how I joined that group. And it was then a subset. It was transferred to the smaller group. Now, not so small, but a smaller group than color television in the black and white television. And it was under the management of a certain Mr. Von Heeren. I think he's already nine. Van Heeren. Van Heeren. And he wasn't German. And that was a side activity at that moment. And I started there in January 1980. The products, the consoles and the cartridges from the States were distributed, I think, in the UK and in Germany and in France somewhere. And it was a big problem because from technical point of view, they were not good. So we had to make a plan to rework all the goodies which came from the States. That was a pain in the ass. And, of course, the software, which was then offered to us via Magnavox, was not really fitted to Europe, so to say. So what did we do? I didn't do it alone, hoor. I had a very tough boss and all kind of colleagues who knew everything better than I did, of course. What we did first, we organized a think tank, as we called it those days, with the countries where the hardware and the software was already distributed, via the distribution organization of Philips, dus the own Philips organizations. I will come back later to that. That means that we had to make marketing plans and industrial plans and software development plans at that moment, 43 years ago now, eh? Yeah. Something like that. And I was still young, and then we had discussions with the responsible people of the national sales organizations and with all kind of people who had some industrial or technological or development background. The first thing was what was decided was to take back all the shit from the big countries where those Odyssey consoles were already distributed, and all those boxes, they were sent back to organization in France, because the television organization was quite big. Color television factories, black and white factories, black and white TV factories, plenty of them in Europe. So by one reason or another, it was chosen to take France, because there was an organization called La Radio Technique. That was a technical organization. I think they also supplied to Radio La or something like that. If you remember well. The Radio Technique organization was headquarters was in Suresnes, close to Boulogne-Billancourt in Paris, with a technical staff digitally, technical staff for production preparation and those kind of things. And some industrial locations were allocated. I think it was Rambouillet, Nogent-le-Rotrou, and Le Mans. Those three cities, there were already factories where there was capacity to do the rework. First, the rework. That was quite complex because the main problem were the joysticks. You have all kinds of plastic sheets in the joystick to make contact, to produce the contacts in the, I think it was eight directions or so. In the enthusiasm of knowing that the production would not be anymore in Knoxville, or in that neighborhood, the staff was rather reluctant, the factory would be closed, and they had put three or four of those plastic sheets instead of one in the joysticks, and then you have the McDonald's effect. If you buy one hamburger, you get in Holland 25 of those napkins. And those plastic sheets, they were disturbing, so you could not play the games. So we have reworked everything, and then also instructed the factory in, or the Radio La organization with the development group, to have a better look technically in the chips and the technical performance of those sets. It was not because of a reason that also Radio Technique was chosen, because at that moment the French government was introducing a telephone book with a very small screen, so that all consumer marketing could then have direct access via such a modem to find the telephone number of the auntie in the south of France they would never visit again. But anyhow, then he had the telephone number. Now, that was kind of a very modern activity in Philips. In that respect, consumer electronics together with digital things. So, in the meantime, if you have questions, just interrupt me.
I was going to stop for a moment and have Ton introduce himself as well.
Ton, yeah.
No, okay, here. Okay. Yeah, I was advertising manager for the Black and White Group, and as such, I also responsible for the Videopak advertising. But that means that responsible for the Videopak advertising in the product division. That is something else than the advertising in the national sales organizations. So the first thing what I did when, especially when we got new Videopaks, all those beautiful drawings and so, that was, let's say, handled by me. I had to find via an advertising agency, people who could make these kind of drawings. And I did that, and I took care that all the right, films, etc., to print, because it was not digital at that moment, went from Holland to France, where the new cartridges were made. But that's one part. Other things we always made in Holland, let's say some kind of the brochures, but as Oscar explained, the national sales organizations were in a lot of aspects were very independent. So we produced them, and then the national sales organization could say, okay, I want also 5,000 of these brochures. But the organization could also say, no, I don't like it. I'll make my own brochure. That was always a part of the discussions. And I was also responsible for a little bit afterwards for color television and so on. And in there we made also commercials and for color television. For Videopak, we have never made a central commercial. That some national organizations did it on their own, but there was never a central commercial. What can I say more? That we regularly, Oscar and his colleagues organized sales conference product conferences where all the national organizations from Europe were sending one or two people, and also there I did often the presentations about new cartridges and about brochures and things that they could get from Holland. But then again, it was always the question, which countries will adopt it and which countries will not adopt it. And there were a few countries which always used our stuff, and there were some countries which never used our stuff and said, we can do it far better than you can do it. Yeah.
They still think so.
So it sounds to me that Philips was not really directly involved with introducing this product to retailers and helping them with.
Oh yes. We were in from 1980 onwards.
Okay, because it sounded more like it was. Well, when I say Philips, I mean the head office and not like the regional country by country. Distribution arms.
Yeah, no, that is. We had a number of distribution models. One was the national organizations, which a subset is then the national sales organization from the individual divisions. The countries in Europe, they all had an own national sales organization for television, so also for Videopak. The only thing is that if you sell millions, hundreds of millions, the television sets, and you come with a new product where software is the moneymaker and not the hardware, then you are in you have different cultures. And that took, I think, 1 or 2 years before that landed more or less in the heads of those people in the national sales organizations. Now, then we talk about national sales organizations in Europe, but we had also, I had not so much to do with that at that moment, the International Overseas Group, IOS, it was called, where we, that was a group in Eindhoven, in Holland, and they exported to small countries, South America. Yeah. And then there was another organization also in the neighborhood of Eindhoven for Videopak, not only for Videopak, but also Videopak was then sold. And that was the direct export organization. And they sold not to smaller countries on the other side of the world, outside Europe, but they sold directly to agents in all kinds of...
In countries where there was no Philips organization itself.
Yeah.
That's
when
they...
That needed a lot of commercial communication, because otherwise every himself respecting manager would go in his own direction. So that it was a total transformation of the total company Philips in the 80s and the 90s, which resulted in a better organization at the end of the 90s. But then at that moment it was still, well, as we call it in Holland, een ratje toe. Nevertheless, for Europe, we had at a certain moment, I think after half a year, we had quite a good policy on what to do with Videopak. If you allow me, then I go to the development aspects or not.
Before we jump to that, I was curious. So you mentioned that you got this first shipment of product in from Knoxville and it didn't work really well. It was kind of defective. Yeah. So once you had that sorted, what was sort of the level of interest within Philips for video games in general and the video pack itself? Do you remember?
Quite high, because at that moment there was something awkward going on, because Philips at that moment sold pickups for the vinyl music and so. And the compact disc was in the works, and the compact cassette was in the works, those kinds of things. But we were always concentrating on hardware. And suddenly, in the end of the 70s, for example, Atari and Pong, they started by making money in an consumer electronics environment, making money on software. And in Philips, that was only Polygram who was doing that, selling vinyl records. And so there was a high interest from the technology side, and as well from the how can we transform such a division to more selling of software, and in the Polaroid model make your money on some, not on the major hardware.
Yeah.
Now that takes a number of years to change that attitude and to change the way of thinking. So yes, there was a high interest. Only it took years and years before that really embedded in all the organizations. And that it was a natural process, especially because you were talking about low quantities in the beginning. And you must imagine that you have to deal and motivate organizations who make hundreds of millions of turnover or profit on the sales of beautiful color television sets, and then ask them to cooperate in the same way for a couple of tens of millions of turnover in video games. So that were two different aspects. So yes, there was a high enthusiasm, especially with the younger people and the elder people with a more technological background, which was Philips then at that moment. It was a bit on a distance.
Okay.
And we had to talk our tongue out of our mouth to have them on our side. Is that an answer on your question?
Yeah, I think so.
We had also a problem then how to continue with that after the repair of all those things. So we asked Radio Techniek to prepare the production of the consoles in Europe. And then with all the technical tricks to make it PAL and SECAM. PAL SECAM really compatible. And all those kind of things, like plugs and I don't know what that was, simple things. And of course, we had to start making more cartridges, developing more cartridges, because at that moment, most of the cartridges came from, or the ideas from the cartridges, came from Knoxville. But in the meantime, in 78, when I mentioned the word Shuttleworth, John Shuttleworth, he always cooperated with a software house somewhere in Sweden. With the guy, a name, what was the name of the guy?
Is that Intron?
A certain Peter Inser and a certain Christer Medin. Mm. Christer Medin, you know. He was working in Sweden for a software house, and they were developing all kinds of games for a number of platforms, as far as I remember, and Videopak was one of them. And then when we started the operation in 1980 to transfer everything to Europe, for in the development thing and at least the management of the hardware and the software development in Holland for Europe, not for America. And then we have asked Christian Medin to join our group in Eindhoven and to be a kind of a software manager because he had the most experience in making games on a various number of other platforms in those days. And then we started software development. And we started hardware development at the same time in 1980, in fact. That means, if I go to the hardware, that we have contracted Alcoma, the electrical components and
materials
development, what is now NXP or something like that, to look into the technical aspects from having those chips in a more or less upcoming digital world. For hardware, so there is a certain plan was made to not to stick with the G7000, but with the Intel 8048 or something like that, and a video interface, and those stupid small cartridges with 2K or 4K ROM, which you could use because then you had a very limited development capacity concerning building the software, with the emulators and these kind of things. That was one part. And the other part was how do we get the nice new games? Now, that was, in fact, an open relationship with a number of software houses. Of course, there were discussions with the countries, what kind of software do you need? Now, I myself, together with a number of people, we have organized all kinds of market research activities. What is a game? Why is a game interesting to play? So we had contacted even board game manufacturers like Monopoly and those kind of things. I think it was called Jumbo or so. And they have taught us, together with the consumer panels groups and the discussion groups which we had, because for us it was new, what makes a game nice. And for the action games it was, we called it shooting bang bang. And that is not only shooting bang bang in a target, but also having an unexpected element in the game. Like by Monopoly, you play and on a certain moment you can go to prison and those kind of things when you have bad luck. Like Pac-Man, later on with the pills and the chewing persons were doing. Unexpected moments, that was one. The second thing is, how could we use it? That was strategy games. That was something new in those days. And then we had something, intellectual games. That was the chess module. Yes. Later on, only one, the chess model. And then we had also what we called edutainment. I have to recall 43 years ago, edutainment. And that was a kind of the cartridge with add-ons or those kind of things to teach people, to children, to teach them how to behave in traffic. Or what do we have? Oh, yeah, the piano, the music cassette. Music, yeah. That there are two examples of the categories of games. Now, then you need a different category of software houses to deal with. Either you can also program it yourself with a software group. Now, we erected, established a software group in Eindhoven, first under the leadership of Christian Medin, and then later on from renovated software houses with people with a lot of European experience. Schutter or something like that was his name. Ah. And another guy Smelt. But also an hobby that was hardware. And he was also later on working on M6. But we can come to that later. Now, so at that moment, we had open communication. There were, in all the magazines from video games, they were said, if you have good ideas, let us know. We judged that on, is it funny, is it nice, is it good, does it fit in the stupid small cartridges? because it was a very limited system.
Right.
And so on. So there was a lively life to judge at all, because hundreds of good and thousands of bad ideas came in, and that was all filtered out and then put on the table as a good proposition to program yourself, or to let a program house do that, or in a software house, or it was hub in bin, and never think about it anymore. So that is the way how we try to increase the number of interesting cartridges. And Tom made every time, I think there was something like 100 cartridges or so. Eh? I don't remember anymore. I left the group when there were 60 or 70.
Yeah,
or
so somewhere around that.
Then I escaped to another company, to another country. that was the way how we did it. And in the meantime, there was there was quite a lot of what we call then, from our point of view, illegal activities. I have seen all kind of cartridges coming up and EEPROMs coming up with all kind of games. So there were a large number of people who knew how to program those EEPROMs with all kind of funny things. And in some countries, I can remember that even cartridges with video part label were put on the market. But they had never seen them. So that was very interesting. So that was a mishmash. And as I said, in that world, it was all new, like making records and pick up things.
So you folks, if I'm understanding this correctly, they would submit game ideas to you folks in marketing, and then you basically signed off on whether or not they would move ahead with those. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that is fair to say. On the moment that everybody agreed that it was nice and funny and fitting into the four frameworks, so action games, educational games, entertainment, and so on, as long as it fitted in that strategy. And we also knew that in those games, with a very short product life cycle of a hit, like a record, like Michael Jackson was already there at that moment, I don't know. You have a small hit for a couple of months and then it's all over. So that very short life cycle of something was selling like hell, that was very short. So you had also enormous risks in inventory if the life cycle, it was in the end of the product line. And then you had to throw away 100,000 or 200,000 cartridges somewhere. So that all those aspects were all taken into account. So and whether it fitted in the countries where you want to sell, of course, because all our national sales organizations have very savvy managers, especially the younger ones, and they came up with all kinds of ideas for their particular country. So you cannot say yes to everything, and you can also not say no to everything. So that was a mix of judging whether something could sell and could be produced and did fit in the machine. That is, I think, the answer to your question.
So the national sales organizations, those were the ones who decided which games would be published in their particular country, is that right?
No, they request. No, that is not 100%. We were responsible to choose the cartridges. That was a central affair on headquarters. Right. But we had a very strong, very good communication structure with regional managers who visited the countries every 4 to 6 weeks. A number of them, marketing managers we call them, they were traveling, and the input from the national organizations in Europe, that was taken into account by making the decision tree for all the different models, different cartridges you were going to make. And in some countries, people were like the UK, that was all space wars or something like that, space invader type things, shooting, bang, bang, that was all good. And on a certain moment, all kind of home computers came up. Later on, the Sinclairs and the Commodores. So there was a shift going on, and we monitored that shift very very close. And the decision process was made in that way, because you could easily fall flat on your mouth when you had said yes to a certain cartridge or a certain game. And then halfway the development process, you came to the conclusion that very nice and all the technical people very enthusiastic, but you could not earn a penny on it. So that was, in fact, a managerial relatively okay process as I can remember it.
Okay.
have a look, because I have here. Oh yeah, we have also, there was also an interesting aspect that was also in Ton's area. How do you do the visualization, and how do you give the cartridges a name? I remember Atari was very successful because they threw a lot of money to Mr. Spielberg to buy the title E.T., for example. Mm. Now, we have once, that was then Philips, most days, my boss, in fact, has then agreed on buying a title, I think it was Thunderbirds. Thunderbirds, yeah. In the UK, in the same way of thinking. I don't think the cartridge ever came on the market, but I can remember that was an issue, how you can deal with the joy to play the game, but also the marketing aspect, if it is hanging in the racks, but Ton also made for the retail, for all the countries, rack jobbing and those kinds of things, that children would pursue their parents to buy a cartridge with a nice name on it and a nice visualization.
Mm.
There were also aspects where we were playing a big role, of course, in decision what to do, how to visualize it, and that whole package that should sell. And that was a monthly and sometimes a very big meeting with nearly 100 people,
yeah,
on which way do we go, and to to have also the commercial message in all those various countries with the noses in the same direction. Yeah.
Yeah, I know there was a Terrahawks licensed game that came out in Europe, and I was curious the approach for getting that. So that's interesting.
Frankly speaking, I remember the name Terrahawks, but I cannot remember anymore about the legal process from the name and so on. Also. I have no clue anymore. I'm too old for that. But I have seen Terrahawks somewhere in one of the catalogs.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, and strategy games and so, they were all after my time. The only thing was that now and then we had a legal clash because Pac-Man was Pac-Man, and we had Munchkin.
Yes.
And that was a very interesting legal affair because, in fact, you could argue that it was a straightforward copy of Pac-Man, and we had all kinds of lawyers who worked with whom we worked closely together, because there was no jurisprudiction about software issues and the ownership of software. So you could argue, if you would be Atari, we have invented the game. The programmer could have argued he invented the game. And then you say, yeah, but it was programmed in the Atari, for example, the Atari or the Mattel code. And then we could argue, for example, yeah, but our code in the G7000 was totally different. So it is the copyright on our code is the same. And then you have a discussion about emulators, which no lawyer could ever understand. And then you had later on the visualization and a number of pixels, where you can clearly say the Atari game, the Mattel game, or whatever it is, has a different number of pixels on the screen than Videopac or Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And then you had the visualization this Ton was doing, how to market the whole thing. And you had, of course, the name connected to it, but it was a totally apart ownership of all kinds of names. So those aspects, I can remember that on the moment Philips introduced Munchkin, where everybody said it is exactly the same as Pac-Man. That busloads of lawyers were traveling, and planes with lawyers were traveling between the courthouses in the UK and in Hamburg and all those kind of things. And I must say, the judges in those days were also not very well of the jurisprudentia in copyrights and software, because in 1 week, one court could say Philips is right and the other Intel is right or Atari is right or something like that. That made life very funny and interesting. Never a boring moment at that moment. So that was another interesting aspect. I can also tell you, if you want me to tell, something about the chess game.
Yeah, I was very curious. So I know that there were several games that only came out in Europe, and I know that was one of them, and I know it required a whole hardware attachment just to run the chess game. So I was curious if you could speak to how that came together.
Coincidentally, I was the owner of the problem, so to say. I don't know whether you are ever sailing or surfing in the beach. Now, I was doing that somewhere in 1982 or so in the south of France. And I was laying on my on the towel. And besides me was sitting a man. He was also Dutch in the French environment, having holiday. And he owned a software house in Amsterdam. I cannot remember his name. I know his name. I cannot mention him. And he had bought a license of a video game, sorry, a chess program package with a high ELO level, which was then running on a Z80 processor. And it was sold. He was selling it to, I think it was called Tandy Stores. Tandy Stores. And I went to the Tandy Stores because I had nothing else to do. And with my hands in my pockets, and I looked at the console, the Tandy TRS-80 it was, and a keyboard, and then I said, hey. I myself played chess when I was young, quite often. Mm. I was very interested in those kind of things, and with the ELO rating, and then Big Blue, my ex-employer, was also working on the Kasparov game thing, the chess game thing. Right. So I said, how can we have such a program on our G7000? So I rushed to Christer Medin, the software guru, with us, and he said, "Now, if you now throw away the keyboard of the TRS-80 and you throw away the tube, the picture tube of the TRS-80, what do you have then? Oh, yeah, just a print board. I said, oh, that's interesting. How can that print board then talk to our G7000? And then Christer Medin was thinking about it for 2 days, and he developed an interface. So we made a cartridge like the normal Odyssey cartridge, but the hardware didn't fit in that simple cartridge. And that was a complete TRS-80 inside. I say it in my words. And then we packed that thing in a kind of rucksack. And that was that. Do you see it?
Yeah. I see the picture of it. Yeah.
No, and then half a year later, we had the prototype of the thing. We made a commission agreement with the guy from whom we bought the rights for the program. We went again to La Radio Technique. They were enthusiastic. And half a year later, it left already the production lines in France. And I think it was less than 100,000, but it was a sky high consumer price. And also there, the development in chess computers came up, handheld chess computers, which you could use in your lap in the plane and those kind of things. I had a number of them because I played chess every day. But this was the only solution to come to a chess computer. And it was good for publicity and so on. So that is the whole history about the thing. It was just, in fact, bought Fixum Fertig. From somebody else, and we put another piece of plastic around it with an interface developed on in-house. That is, in fact, the answer. And that was funny. And you could ask a fortune for it in retail price. So every chess member club would like to have such a thing for that price, because the other computers were thousands of dollars, and these were only a couple of hundred or so. Something like that. I think it was 1983, 84, 1982, 83. I don't remember.
So, speaking of hardware developments in Europe, who was doing the hardware development for devices that only came out in Europe, like the G7200, the one with the built-in screen, or the G7400? And what role did marketing play in getting those together?
The first thing, when you introduced the normal G7000 with the cartridges, every half year, IBM was announced. I worked there myself. Every 2 months, they introduced a new platform or a new generation of computers, as did the consumer products do in those days as well. So the first question is, how can you look in the future and how can you predict the prices of chips? And what does that mean for the capacity of the game you can put in such a cartridge or in another medium? And then you start, of course, with the console. And if the console is too limited in its computing capabilities, or the video chip, the video interface, I think it was called, I think that were the two things. The rest was a little bit power supply and a little bit print boards and so, and a little bit plastic and some joysticks. So we developed a number of things after torturing our brains, which was in fact sometimes easy, because sometimes easy come in a nice way. But the G7000, we tried to upgrade the CPU. That was not possible. We tried to upgrade, I think it was the video interface, and that was called, I think, the G7400. And that was, that is the 200, 400. That was nothing else than a video face interface, if I remember well. I cannot find it back after all those years, to improve the graphics capabilities, I have to say, so that you could make better games. And then in the meantime, you have to use a CPU or an extension to the CPU that you can also plug in bigger cartridges than only 4K at that moment. 4K ROM it was, or 4K EEPROM. And you would like to go to what is yet now in a USB stick. But that was then dreaming about the future. So that with that question, we went to, I was traveling every Thursday from Eindhoven to Paris, years and years, with all kind of people who really know how it worked, because I'm a commercial guy, not technical. But right. there were all kind of meetings, and there was a triangle relation with the Alcoma division, who developed the chips, the existing NXP, where all kind of groups, I think 20, 30 people, were working on those kind of interfaces, not only for as customer inside Philips, but also for customers outside Philips. And that is the way how I have to look back now in a number of papers I found in a very dusty booth thing. One moment. Yeah, there was a G7000, the 7400, the better graphics, and then we had a plan for the 7400 add-on. That was in fact based on the chess cartridge principle that you then could add. Because at that moment also IBM started with a home computer or so, that you have computing power also. They can even do more than only shooting bang bang and so. When we were walking around in France, in La Radio Technique, they had the telephone book, and then we had an idea. That was coincidence. Can a G7000 not be fitting in the plastic housing of that telephone book thing? And yes, with the black and white tube, that was that one, the G7200. That was then just the hardware, one-to-one plugged in the thing. So take out all the electronics, with that garbage from that thing. What they had there on the market, and they sold tens of millions of pieces to the government, because they were behind that. And we took just the plastic casing, the video pack cartridge could fit in it, and then you were not, because we also noticed from market research, and just by talking to your customers, of course, that if you have kids in the house and you want to see the late news in the night with the kids in the living room, and the kids, they pull out the coax cable and they would start playing the game. And not good for your marriage. And that was then a solution. And then we said, let's start with the black and white thing that was available, already available in France. And later on, if that's a success, put in a color tube picture. How do you call it? Color tube in it. That was it. So that was a nice thing. And then in the meantime, you have more space, physically more space to change to new boards with new processors, where we had to talk our tongue out of our mouth that something like compatibility is key in this business. In the television world, you had a new generation of television sets, color or black and white, based on a new technology. And then you put it in a new television set, and then it was sold as an innovation. But there was no backwards compatibility, only that you had to be PAL, CCOM, or NTSC, and the rest was all the rest you could forget. Now, if you have an outstanding park of cartridges, then that doesn't work. So forward and backward compatibility, I can remember that was a hot issue in various meetings where people who did not really understand the business were having very nice discussions. And then there was even another project. Oh yeah, there was the G9000, and that never came.
That
has never been born.
Yeah, what was that?
That I think I already left the group then. That would be introduced in 84, 85, or the end of 85, and that was a complete new thing, but then more based on home computer technology.
Okay, because I remember reading some internal documents that went online some years ago about in the U.S. they were discussing Odyssey 4 around that sort of time frame, and I'm wondering if that might have been the same
that
piece of hardware.
It could have been the same. I can remember that Magnavox was doing all kinds of things on his own for the U.S. market, and there was a spin-off to NTSC countries, they thought, of course. Then there was a complete thought. First of all, Magnavox as a company was less independent as when we started in 1980. So there was more and more involvement via 42nd Street headquarters in New York of the Philips organization. And a couple of people left the company, Knoxville, and so on. So there was a better cooperation. And maybe it was concluded, but I think I already left then, that if you go and want to develop this business, you have to have a worldwide view and not only a USA view or a European view or a South America view or something like that. So that was the hardware development, and in the meantime, we also were investigating home computers because they came up. Do you have more questions about video games as such? Because
So I know the common narrative that today is that Europe was mostly interested in home computer games and not so much in these sort of TV games. How did that?
That's not really true.
How did that bear out in your experience?
Now the whole thing was that it started all with shooting bang bang, space invader types, and then it developed and then on a certain moment you see the limitation to video games, and then there were another number of companies, and I will mention some which I listed, I think, 40 years ago. That was Atari, Mattel, Coleco, and there were another number. But I have to look in some papers. Yeah, at this moment that you are enthusiastically busy marketing video pack and all those models we just have mentioned with all the software hazards around it, we were investigating in 1983 Atari, Apple, Commodore, IBM, Sinclair, and ourselves, of course, as the main players. Because that were the best candidates to start, because you had in Europe everywhere those Commodore 20 and Commodore 64 clubs, where they made all kind of games. And then we said, and they had much more capacity than our games, G7000 and so. And then also Sinclair was busy introducing all kind of games, and all kind of software houses were diving into those kind of hardware solutions, which were brought by the hardware industry to make a number of games as well. And we came to the conclusion that, in fact, you had to make a split in marketing and product development for hardware as well as software, in entertainment, educational, home computer, all kinds of things we are now doing, home computer, and personal computing, then maybe an overlap with small business, and then you went to the mainframes. That was the whole array of type of computers we could at that moment define 40 years ago. And we said, on a certain moment, you can make fantastic games when you would use the existing technology from IBM or from all those, the Honeywells and so on. Then you could make magnificent games. What is now, in fact, if I now walk on the Fuchsstellung in Germany, then I see visualized with all the kind of youngsters with long hair. then you see them playing all kind of nice games, but in fact is a capacity what we thought in the 80s that would never be possible for consumer use. So that was a very healthy tension between what can you do and how do you develop your hard and software in the on those games. It was the conclusion was quickly made that you could not do that with the hardware type of video games. So Philips was going to investigate on home computers. Now, that was a fantastic discussion. And on Seth... you don't speak Dutch, but I was kicked out of a meeting because I was not so agreeing with the MSX choice. On a certain moment, in a Philips organization, big organization, I worked for a number of large multinationals. And on the moment that the business is growing in billions of dollars and a small business unit is suddenly, what we were running was hundreds of millions of dollars turnover with a nice, very nice profit. And on a certain moment, they put managers from abroad, not abroad, and from other divisions in because they know the business better. They say, now, on that moment, they bring in new managers, which have a lot of talents, but not the talent to analyze the video game business or the home computer business in detail. So that meant that on a certain moment, I think it was in the mid of 84, at that moment, new managers from Philips have chosen for the MSX solution. I think it came from Kyocera or something like that in Japan. At that moment, I started crying, and I think indirectly I said here, I don't want to work anymore. It was not black and white, but I didn't see that at all because all kinds of typical things were happening. Where I said, what is then with software compatibility? If you go to MSX, in which countries do you have MSX? Who is going to invest in software in MSX? Who would do without a hardware base, without having... but as far as I understand, in an ultimate attempt, they have tried to transfer with all kinds of software houses, the video game software from Odyssey and from the Atari-based platform or from the Coleco-based and the Mattel-based platforms to make all kinds of games one-to-one copy to a home computer environment, but later on became a personal computer environment. Is that an answer to your question?
I think so. So I know that, jumping back a little bit to the G7400, I know that there were plans to release that in the US as the Odyssey 3, and those never came to fruition. Do you know if those affected, or that failure affected the release plans for that hardware in Europe at all?
As far as I know, I cannot remember that at all. I'm too old for that. It can be it was a hot issue because... We had closed down already in 1980 the production for Europe in Knoxville, and then they continued locally with producing the Odyssey. And it was a guy called Staup or something like that. Mike Staup?
Yeah. Mike Staup, yeah.
Yeah, he came regularly over to Eindhoven. I had a nice meeting with him. He was also still young and lively. And I think they did all kinds of things outside the scope of, I think, outside our managerial scope. I think we knew what was happening, but we were concentrating on Europe and the organizations where Tom made all the material for, the International Overseas Group and the smaller distributor activities, which was quite a work. He worked his ass off for 4 years long, right? 5 years long, 6 years long, but he still looks young.
I'd like to actually pick his brain a little bit. I've always heard that the VideoPak did very well for Philips in South America, particularly Brazil, and I know there's some games that were only published in that region.
Yeah.
So any insight into how it was received down there and how well it did?
Maybe Tom can answer that, but I cannot remember that I've dealt with South America itself. now and then some straying product manager or so, or sales manager visited us in Eindhoven. I think there was an activity. I think it went. I have never been involved with South America. I knew they were selling games, and maybe you made then also material for them. That was the IT organization, I think.
Yeah, I don't think so. We made it specifically for Brazil.
I cannot remember.
Never.
I think it was Copycat, maybe that Miami played, the Free Trade Zone played a role in that.
Okay.
I strongly suspect after 40 years that maybe Odyssey, was it also NTSC in Brazil?
Nee.
That somehow via Miami consoles and cartridges ended up somewhere in South America.
Okay.
And quite some quantities, I think. I have quantities in front of me. If you are interested in market shares and these kind of things.
Yeah, sure. I would be interested in knowing how the video pack did.
I left Philips more than 20 years ago. They cannot sue me anymore. but it is my own scribblings from what I found back, but not so much. That secretary then. 1982, the market in... We concentrated in the UK, Germany, France, Italy, and the Netherlands. That were the five countries that were the most important for us. And the rest was small. Sweden and Belgium, and so they all participated, were small. Total market in 83 was about just under 2 million pieces hardware. And we were running for a market share of 20-25%. And the rest was more or less Atari and those kind of things. Wow. At that moment, we had also beautiful tables because we had a very intense contact, meeting-wise, but also financially. They earned a fortune in it on GFK, the Market Research Institute, who monitored the retail sales. What the ratio was between the cartridges and the hardware. And that was monitored very precisely by GFK for all the brands who were active in it. And I have figures here in Europe, USA, and overseas. Overseas, it was in South America, I think. But we had a ratio. It started with 7 cartridges in 1980 per video game console. And then it was in 1984, it was planned to go to somewhere around 1.9, 1.10. To 9 or 10 cartridges. Perfect. And then per console, sold console, so the park. And then you have a very nice curve. Hardware failure after 5 years, or joysticks didn't work anymore, those kind of things. But that was more or less the what you could sell in that particular year on the outstanding park. That was interesting. So the numbers quickly went up in cartridges, and the number of consoles quickly went up. And our main goal was, of course, like Atari did, Coleco did, and those kind of guys, to take care that you had a very big park of hardware consoles. We were then wondering what market share you could reach with a new generation of hardware and new generation of software. And with the gray area, because the Sinclairs and the names I just mentioned, left and right, everywhere popped up. I've even been a member of the Dutch Home Computer Club, the HHC, but I only could speak with nerds, which were doing all kind of... We were interested more in the electronic boards than the whole business model. But that was, I think, 2 or 3 years that more technical-oriented people were interested in those things than the real commercial guys. Nevertheless, everybody saw the enormous potential which was there all around the corner. I also have here... Philips and Magnavox together. Magnavox did not have such a high market share in 1982 in the USA. That was more Atari, with 75%. Mm-hmm. At that moment in the USA, it was Magnavox, Atari, Coleco, and Mattel, if I have to believe my own remarks. And in Europe, it was mainly Philips and Atari, and a little bit Mattel. Mattel was just starting with a beautiful system. And they pre-financed, I think, Barbie film this year. home computers, that was a diversified picture. USA was far growing faster than Europe, with a number of brands, Apple, Atari, Commodore, Sinclair came up in the USA strongly. Tandy came here, and Texas, I think Texas Instruments.
Tandy. Oh, Texas.
Texas. That's Tandy, Texas. And then I think some Japanese toddlers came up with less than 2% market share. And in Europe, the Japanese were much stronger because they had very, I think in Europe, they had better distribution structures, the Toshibas and the Sonys and the Sanyos and so, than I think in America, because there you have all kind of other brands. And that, of course, that is interrelated concerning distribution. And if you don't have your distribution in your pocket, then you have also a problem. Because then you have beautiful things, but you can't sell them, I would say. So that is, in fact, the transfer to home computers. And then I left. And you still work there, I think, Tom, for another three, yeah, 4 years?
Yeah, but not 4 years, so less.
Less than 4 years.
To another department. But it was MSX, and that has hardly been a success. I don't think we did.
That was a big disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if you speak Dutch. Niks in Dutch, that is nothing.
Nothing.
And I was once in a meeting and I said, MSX, that is niks. And because of that alliteration, it cost me my bonus, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, naming schemes when changing languages is always a bit of a struggle, isn't it?
Yeah. Hey, but MSX, yeah, that I can remember that there was because then there was also in Philips another development that was the P2000. Remember that?
I'm not familiar. If you want to touch on that, so
there was
another division.
There was another division, and there was a guy called Dr. Kroon, and he was then very young. I think he passed away already, and he had an own laboratory in the city of Gelderhof, close to Eindhoven, and he was working, but under the supervision of data systems, and a liaison or data system, something like that, on a personal computer for educational purposes, with a very small cartridge in it, the mini cartridge, which was later on used for the telephone answering machines. Mm. I don't know whether you had them, but those ones at home. That was the data carrier for that machine. And that they were trying to sell to the via the Philips data systems or sales organization in Holland, to schools, colleges, so that people could be familiar with computers and so on. I think because of the government interest, it was sold a little bit, but you could not play games on it. But it was a typical niche market education. Well, now if I look around here in the high school in my own village where I live now, all the kids from 8 years onwards have an own laptop. Yeah. Now, and then it was only the high school or pre-college or something like that, the pre-university. And that was also a total separate development where nobody could invent really consumer applications for. That came 2-3 years later, while the real home computers were introduced, in fact.
Okay.
And let me have a look whether I ignore all my checklist. Yeah, shows and exhibitions. I cannot find back anymore, but you have also, together with the German organization. The German organization was in those days enormously enthusiastic. And we had a very professional guy, Gerhard. What was his name? I don't remember. And we had even a stand. Now, if you would be on the CES, it would be impressive. I think it was in an exhibition, electronics exhibition in Hannover or something like that, where they have built a kind of an Evoluon and a kind of a futuristic booth with all kind of nice ladies demonstrating the video park games and so on. Also, those activities, they helped a lot in our marketing activities. And Tom, you also made all the rack jobbing things and so on. Display racks, which had to be multi-country applicable. Yeah. So with all kind of slid in things for the local language and the local cartridges, but were done, but he already explained, sometimes there were different cartridges, or some cartridges came not even on the market in some countries. We had one, which was called Dambusters. I don't know how your history knowledge is, about 1945. And that was the plane which dropped the bomb on the dam. I think that was not the most popular cartridge in Germany, you can imagine.
So, I can't imagine why.
So, for commercial reasons, maybe those were not always on display. But it was very, very, very funny. Let me have a look. Home computers, your advertising things. Oh, yeah. We spent a fortune on Tom's department. It was in, because we, of course, have turnover 2/3, and we have gross margin, as we call it in Europe. And then you have selling expenses. But if you sell radios or televisions or so, you have a very small percentage of your turnover in advertising. But with us, it was an enormous percentage. I cannot mention the percentage. Nee, sorry, Wiener, yeah? Do we still have problems with lawyers for Philips now, right? It was an enormous amount of money where from Ton developed that for the central, from the central headquarters, like he explained, in the visualization and everything. And all the counties could eat it or not eat it. But most counties, after a couple of years, were eating it.
Yeah, most of them.
Because otherwise you have different messages to your consumers and to your dealers, not to. And also those commercials should have also made sense, should make sense for all countries involved.
Yeah.
And not all countries have the same habits. I have been in small domestic appliances and coffee business, but I can tell you that Americans drink different coffee than the Italians or the French people. And the same is valid for consuming video games. Yeah. Mm. So every region, every... subgroup of people or hundreds of millions of people do something different. But you always made that material and you had in your back pocket huge sum, at least not directly to spend by you.
Indirectly.
Otherwise you would have had a bigger house. but the national sales organizations, they spent enormous amounts of money where in the beginning the definition of the target group was so funny. Remember, Ton, in 1980-81, that we defined in the group, in our marketing group, whose attention should you attract in a page-wide ad, color ad, in the biggest newspaper in Holland or in Germany or in France or something like that. And then we came at that moment to the kids who were playing the shooting bang bang games. And the father and mother. So we call that the happy family.
Yeah.
The happy family with two kids, one boy, one girl. And that was then the concept for, I think, 3/4 of a year or so. Now we have laughed our heads off to sell that thought and to sell the visualization and those kind of things. But we had done in-depth research why that was at that moment the target group. That was not the guy sitting in the laboratory like the guys with it, Matrix games or so. And that was, of course, a total different message 3 years later than that we started computing power to sell. So that was a very lively thing, and we have laughed our heads off years and years long. I think I am more or less at the end of my mini story.
So it sounds like the VideoPak product line ended when you had these new executives come in that were more interested in the MSX and the computer lines and everything. Yeah. So what did you folks go on to do after the VideoPak party ended?
That is a question all my new bosses also asked and could never answer. Tom, what did you do?
Yeah, I went to the overseas group. There was a special video overseas group in Eindhoven, and I became the advertising manager for that group.
Only for games or for all the products?
No, for all the products. But it was in the video division, so it was for black and white, but not much black and white, mainly color television. Because... I've been to quite some countries, also South America, etc. But it was all lot of attention for the introduction of color television at that time. And that was also a lot of centralization. Again, same story. We tried to centralize it as much. So we had produced central in Eindhoven commercials, and they were used in the national sales organizations. But still, only a part. So it's the same as with Feeding Pack. They had also their own commercials. But we had quite a good, strategy for introducing what were the main messages to have to get across for introducing color television. And
that was in the time that 16x9 came up and so, or not?
No, before.
Before, yeah, still before. Yeah, 16x4, yeah, 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 yeah. So long ago. Yeah. And then? After that?
Colore Sempre Vivo. And then afterwards, I went to a complete different department where I was mainly involved with sponsoring.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and very that was a very, very nice time in Philips. Mm-hmm. I know all the main football stadiums in Europe. I've been to Olympic Games in Atlanta and in
Sydney. And you visited me in Sydney.
And Sydney.
Yeah.
There was still a time that Philips sponsored World Championship football and Olympic Games, etc.
Swimming.
That is overall.
Philips is now a very small company in comparison with those days. Yes, that was it. And now you're retired already since 1 month.
I retired in 1999, so already 24 years.
Oh, but that you can still remember this all.
It's pretty nice.
It's amazing, yeah. And for me, it was very simple. I was then still young. I think I was 30 or 31 that I left Philips.
I went to Singapore.
In 1995, I went to Singapore for Philips. Regional office, televisions, video recorders for Asia-Pacific, Australia, New Zealand. Done that for 3 years. Then I did consumer products in Thailand. Locally in a national sales organization, which was the most beautiful 3 years of my life. Then I was I had the opportunity to go to, in the mid-90s, early 90s, to Switzerland for 2 years, where Philips was in difficulties. And we had to do some reorganizations, second brands out, and mergers of organizations, more the managerial work, not managerial, the organizational work, I should say.
Yeah. Your cat is waking up.
Yeah. Your cat. Hey, he's saying, what a boring story, he thinks. and then I went 5 years to small domestic appliances for doing the same work as video pack, but then for household equipment. Regional manager, Europe and Canada, by the way. Then I had the jackpot. They transferred me to Moscow, where I lived for 3 years, doing the business for domestic appliances, small domestic appliances. And I was kicked out in the ruble crisis, out of the country, by the way. And then 3 years in Sydney, where Ton visited me during the Olympics, also domestic appliances. And then Philips and me split in a not so nice atmosphere. And then I worked for 2 years as commercial director for digital television with Thomson in London and Paris. And later on in, what was it? China, name a country, on the production side and the sales for domestic appliances, small domestic appliances, because the industry left to China. It was not anymore available for Molex and Tefal and all these kinds of brands, Kenwood and De'Longhi. All came from the factory, and I had those contacts. It was nice working there. And the last thing was Dubai for Belkin and Linksys, if you know those names. I was there, they did region as interim manager living in Dubai. And then I went back to Holland, and now I am enjoying strawberries, herring, and And what else?
And hockey.
Beer.
Yeah.
Beer. And sometimes hockey. Yeah.
And so, sounds like a great time right there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for talking with me. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I would like to add that I didn't, if don't misinterpret me, I didn't do that alone. Eh? There were large numbers of people doing the real work, so to say. Eh? I just, and the moderator at this moment, but I was the product manager, but I reported to a very tough boss at that moment, also very friendly, but also tough. And there are all kinds of departments, the hardware department, the software department, the industry, the liaisons in the, because we spent millions and millions of dollars on developing the new video interface in-house, what I said in the Alcoma group, and so on, but was not a big success. So, but overall, it was a very funny, interesting, business-wise, day and night working, but very funny life. I still miss it.
A bit.
A bit. Yeah. Yeah.
This has been a Retronauts podcast. You can find us online at retronauts.com and on social media under the name Retronauts. This includes Blue Sky and, as of this recording, Twitter. This is a Patreon-supported show at patreon.com/retronauts. At the $3 level, you get each episode 1 week early and at a higher bitrate. And at the $5 level, you also get access to Friday bonus episodes, Diamond Fight's weekly columns, and the Retronauts Discord server. It's an absolutely stellar bargain, if I do say so myself. And as for me, you can find me on social media under Ubersaurus, on Blue Sky and Twitter, under Uberus at mastodon.social on Mastodon, and through my YouTube series Atari Archive, where I delve into the history and context of the Atari 2600 library in chronological order, with excursions into competing platforms and games, such as the Odyssey 2. I'm supported in that effort through my own Patreon, patreon.com/AtariArchive, and through sales of my book, Atari Archive Volume 1, on sale through Limited Run Games and Amazon. Thank you for listening!